First of all, thank you very much for the invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's my first time at the Perimeter Institute, so it's a very nice facility. It's really nice. So, first of all, these slides are posted on my website, and most of what I'll talk about is available in a preprint. It's joint work with Jonathan Brunden and with Ben. So what I want to talk about is I want to define a family of categories, which we'll call quantum Heisenberg categories, that categorify the Heisenberg algebra, right? And I won't assume that people know what categorification is, so I'll explain what I mean by categorifying an algebra. And a lot of the motivation comes from the way these categories act on other categories of modules, for instance. So I'll mention a little bit about that action and what we use these categories for, what some of the applications are. So this category will be defined in terms of things called string diagrams. And again, I don't want to assume that people are familiar with string diagrams. I know some of you are, but I'll start off with just reviewing this formalism for looking at monoidal categories drawing string diagrams. And then I'll define these categories that we're interested in, this quantum Heisenberg category. I'll try and motivate a bit where the definition comes from. And then I'll mention how they act on other categories of modules, which is part of the reason we're interested in studying them. And then at the very end, I'll mention some future directions for other work. So let's start off with strict monoidal categories. All right, so what is a strict monoidal category? It's some category, C, that's equipped with a tensor product. So a tensor product is a bifunctor from C times C to C. And there is a unit object. And what are the properties that this tensor product should have? It should be associative. And this unit object should act like a unit. Right? So this is a strict monoidal category. That's all it is. So there are lots of monoidal categories that probably most mathematicians are familiar with. For instance, you could take the category of vector spaces. This has a tensor product. But it's not really a strict monoidal category because you know, if these are all vector spaces, and that's the usual tensor product of vector spaces, this is not equality for vector spaces. But there's some canonical isomorphism between these two. So for a strict monoidal category, we really want these things to be equal. And that's what the word strict means. If you have just a monoidal category that's not strict, you've got canonical isomorphisms between these two sides here that have to satisfy some sort of coherence conditions. So this is OK that we deal with strict monoidal categories, because for us, we're going to just define these things from scratch, so we can just require them to be strict. And also, in terms of applications, it's a fact, this MacLane coherence theorem, that every monoidal category is equivalent to a strict one. So in a sense, you can sort of work with strict monoidal categories, and you don't really run into any problems because of this coherence theorem. Okay, so for us, all our monoidal categories will be strict. And we need a little bit more structure on our categories. So we want them to be linear, right? So what does it mean to be linear? We fix some commutative ground ring, can be a field if you want. And a strict K-linear monoidal category has the additional structure that between any two objects, the space of morphisms is actually a module over this ring. And then we want composition to be bilinear and tensor product to be bilinear. Okay, so for example, if you don't worry about this strict issue, if you take, say, K to be a field and you take the category of vector spaces over this field, this is a linear monoidal category, because the space of linear maps between any two vector spaces is itself a vector space. You've got this K-module structure. Tensor product is bilinear, and composition is bilinear. Right? So that's sort of an example you can keep in mind. And one thing that is important for us, and we'll come back to a little bit later, is that it follows from the axioms of a strict monoidal category that you have what's called the interchange law. So the interchange law is the following. If you have two morphisms in your category, say F and B, F goes from A1 to A2, and G goes from B1 to B2, then there are various ways to get a morphism from A1 tensor B1 to A2 tensor B2. You can first apply 1 tensor G and then F tensor 1. You can first apply F tensor 1 and then 1 tensor G. Or your tensor product gives you a new morphism F tensor G that just goes directly from here to here. And the interchange law is that all these are equal, right? This composition, and this diagonal arrow. So this is the interchange law. We think of being able to interchange F and G, right? They sort of commute. No, even if it's not strict, this is still true. Okay, so let me give you some way of thinking about common algebraic structures as categories. So if you have a strict monoidal category that just has one object, right, then what do you have? You've got, all you've got is morphisms from that object to itself, and you've got this tensor product operation on these morphisms, and you've got composition, right? You've got two operations. But then actually you can show that these operations coincide, and you get a commutative operation. So in fact, this is exactly just a commutative monoid, right? And conversely, any commutative monoid is a one-object monoidal category. So commutative monoids are sort of a simple example of a strict monoidal category. And then if you throw in them being K-linear, then of course you've got this K-module and this operation which you can show has to be commutative. And so a one-object K-linear monoidal category is just a commutative associative unital K-algebra. I should have said one object here, a one object type of these categories. Okay, so I want to define some strict monoidal categories that categorify the Heisenberg algebra. So let me tell you what I mean by categorification. Categorification can mean various things in different contexts, but we're interested in one particular type of categorification. So let's say you have an additive category. So an additive category is just any category that you're used to using this symbol of direct sum is probably an additive category. So it's a category we have a natural notion of a direct sum. Then you can form what's called the growth and Dieck group or split growth and Dieck group of this category. So you start off by taking the free abelian group on the isomorphism classes of objects. So just think of formal Z-linear combinations of isomorphism classes of objects in this category. And then you mod out by a relation. You mod out by the relation that the class of a direct sum is the sum of the classes. And this is called the split growth and Dieck group. Okay, the word split comes from the fact that you're modding out essentially by split short exact sequences. So if your category is not only additive but also monoidal, so you've got a tensor product, then this growth and Dieck group is not just an abelian group, but it's actually a ring, because you can define the product of two classes to be the class of the tensor product. So you actually get a ring. So for the purposes of this talk, when I say we want to categorify some ring or maybe some algebra, what we mean is we want to find some additive monoidal category such that the growth and Dieck group of that category is isomorphic to that ring in this sense, right? So that's what we mean by categorification, for the purposes of this talk at least. Okay, so what is the particular algebra or ring that we want to categorify? So it's the Heisenberg algebra. Okay, so let me remind you what that is. So we'll fix some central charge K. So this is some parameter. And first of all, let's start off with the simplest Heisenberg algebra. So the simplest Heisenberg algebra is just this rank one algebra. It's associative algebra, has two generators, which we'll call P plus and P minus, and this relation. Right? So this relation comes up in physics. This is the canonical commutation relation in physics. For instance, it's the relation up to some scalar that is satisfied by position and momentum operators, or in the quantum harmonic oscillator, you see this relation. So this is not quite the Heisenberg algebra that we are going to categorify. We're going to categorify an infinite rank analog of this Heisenberg algebra. So we'll have an infinite number of generators. We'll have these p plus or minus n for every positive integer n. And for any generators that have different indices, they just commute. And if you fix an index, then they give exactly this relation, well, with an extra factor of n. So we have sort of infinitely many copies of this Heisenberg algebra.
So far, it's not
a curve. Well, it's the K here.
Yeah, but I mean, they could have rescaled.
Yeah, so.
But you can't
rescale. You can't rescale categorically. This is the problem, because you can't divide by things in a category. Because in general, so we'll see that this will be the isomorphism class of some object.
Okay, but what, I mean, K will be
K will be some number of copies of the identity object, right? So you can't. Yeah, you could, you know, divide everything by square root of k here, but you can't do that in the level of categories because this will be a whole object.
So take some sums and take some variable thing. Is it, are you just going to build something for k plus 1 and then kind of?
It'll be for arbitrary k. What you'll see is, okay, so what we'll see is essentially that these will correspond to, say, some induction and restriction functors. And we'll have that induction restriction is isomorphic as a functor to restriction induction plus k copies of the identity functor. And that really involves the k. The level of the category you can't rescale. So, you know, in general, in the Heisenberg algebra, this is often some central element, but when you act on any irreducible representation, it acts by some scalar, and what we really see is that specialization. Okay, so this is the thing that we're interested in categorifying. We want to define some strict monoidal category whose growth endiant group is isomorphic as a ring to this ring, this algebra. Okay. So I want to draw some pictures. I want to draw all our strict monoidal categories using the language of string diagrams. Okay, so some of you are familiar with this, but I don't want to assume that everybody is. So let's define these pictures. So we'll have some strict monoidal category C. So when we want to denote a morphism from an object A to an object B, we'll draw it as a picture like this, some string. So the objects will be labels at the top and bottom of this string. We'll always read our pictures from bottom to top. So this is the domain and the codomain. And then we'll label, the morphism will be some coupon on this strand. Okay. So the identity map we will typically denote by a string with no label. So this is the identity morphism in this category from the object A to the object A. And sometimes it'll be clear from the context what the object is, or maybe we'll say give this an orientation to indicate what object it is, and then we won't draw these labels at the top and bottom. Okay, so in a monoidal category, we've got a couple things we can do with morphisms. We've got the composition of morphisms, and we've got the tensor product of morphisms. So composition will be denoted by vertical stacking. Right? So we just stack one morphism on top of another, and remember we read from bottom to top. So this is G followed by F. So it's this, this morphism. And the tensor product is horizontal juxtaposition, right? So when I draw a diagram like this, this is just the tensor product of these two morphisms. So one nice thing you see right away is that this interchange law that I wrote earlier algebraically just becomes this fact that these coupons can slide past each other horizontally. Because if you're reading bottom to top, this is 1 tensor G followed by F tensor 1. And this is F tensor 1 followed by 1 tensor G, and this is F tensor G. And the fact that these are equal was exactly that interchange law. So this is one thing that makes these pictures very nice, is that you can just slide these things, and this is just the interchange law for a monoidal category. So sometimes we'll want to define morphisms that just go directly between two tensor products, and so then it can be a coupon like this with various incoming strands on it. Right? Okay, so we're going to define these strict monoidal categories by giving presentations. We're going to give generators and relations for categories. Okay, and so how do we do this? It's very similar to how you give presentations for monoids or groups or algebras. It's just now you're dealing with categories. And so for morphisms, you've got two different types of sort of multiplication. You've got the horizontal and the vertical, the composition and the tensor product. But the idea is the same. So we'll define a category by giving some generating objects, right? So if you have some family of objects, what it means to say that these are generating objects is that an arbitrary object in your category is just some arbitrary tensor product of these generating objects. Okay. And then we'll give some generating morphisms. Right, so we'll give some collection of morphisms between various objects. We'll say these are our generating morphisms. But now because we're in a monoidal category, they generated under these two types of operations. We can compose, which is this vertical stacking, or we can take tensor products. Right, so an arbitrary morphism could be some tensor products of compositions, et cetera. Right, as long as you know, the composition makes sense, that the codomain of this morphism is the domain of this one. And then we'll impose some relations on these morphisms, right? So this is how we'll give presentations of categories. So we'll do everything in terms of pictures. So in terms of pictures, our generating morphisms will be some small pictures, and then we can generate arbitrary ones by just vertically and horizontally composing these things and building bigger pictures out of these smaller ones. And then we impose some relations. You never put them on objects. if you want sort of two objects to, you want to sort of impose some relation on objects, what you really do is you define an isomorphism between them. So let's give a very simple example of this idea. Okay, so let's define sort of the symmetric groups using this type of language. So we can define a K-linear strict monoidal category, let's call it S for symmetric group. So we'll have just one generating object, which means that an arbitrary object in this category is just a tensor product of some copies of this one. Right? So the identity on this object we'll denote by this up arrow. And let's just have one generating morphism, which will go from the tensor product of this object with itself to the same thing. And you can pick any picture you want here. But it's just at the bottom, you should have sort of two up arrows. And at the top, you should have two up arrows, because that tells you what the domain and codomain of this are. So it's very natural to draw this as a string. So before we had a coupon, my coupon is just a crossing. And then we impose these relations. Right? So what do these relations mean? We have this generating morphism. If you compose it with itself, you should get the identity map on this object. And then this is, right, you break these things into pieces. So if you're not used to seeing these things, so let's read it one off. So we can break this into three compositions. This is this crossing generator tensor the identity, composed with the identity tensor this crossing generator, composed with the crossing tensor the identity. Right? And we just impose a relation, then that's equal to this other composition of these generating morphisms. And then it's not hard to see now that in this category, if you look at endomorphisms of the n-fold tensor product of this generating object, you get exactly the group algebra of the symmetric group. Right? These are the crossings you think of as the simple transpositions, and these are exactly the relations that define the symmetric group. Now, one thing that's nice to note here is that this is a very efficient way of describing the symmetric groups. Because what did we have? We had one generating morphism and just two relations. And we got all the symmetric groups for all n in this way. Okay? And there's this distant braid relation. When you write down a presentation from the symmetric group, you don't have just that braid relation, sort of the one that you usually call the braid relation. You've got this distant braid relation. But that comes for free in the language of monoidal categories, because that's just the interchange law that these two things slide past each other. Right? So the symmetric groups in this way are really well adapted to being described in terms of monoidal categories. OK, so let's do a little bit of a more complicated example that'll be more relevant for us. So let's just tweak this description a bit and go from the symmetric group to the braid group. Okay? So now, again, we'll have a strict K-linear monoidal category. We'll have one generating object again. But now, to get the braid group instead of the symmetric group, instead of having just a single transposition, we have this braiding. Right? So we'll have two generating morphisms, the positive crossing and the negative crossing. And what are the relations that we want to impose? Well, these things should be inverses of each other. So that's exactly these two relations, that when you compose these morphisms with each other in either order, you get the identity. So they're inverses of each other. And then this is the braid relation. Okay, so now we've just tweaked this definition to go from symmetric group to braid group. So now if you look at the endomorphisms in this category of the n-fold tensor product, so that would mean you have n strands, you've got these generators and these relations, and you get exactly the group algebra of the braid group. Again, it's a very efficient presentation, and you've got this extra relation that distant generators commute, and that comes for free from the interchange law. Okay, so now let's get Hecke algebras. So Hecke algebras are quotients of the braid group, or the group algebra of the braid group. So we'll fix some parameter z. And so let's now define a category that depends on this z. So it'll be the strict K-linear monoidal category obtained from this category we just defined that gave us the braid groups. But now we impose one extra relation. And the one extra relation is this skein relation, which is that the difference of these crossings is z times the identity. In fact, I said it's invertible. It doesn't have to be. If you take z equals 0, then this thing collapses and gives you this symmetric group category. So now, if you look at endomorphisms in this category of the n-fold tensor product of the generating object, you get the Iwahori-Hecke algebra of type A. when you add in this extra relation. So these are just quotients of the Bray group by exactly this relation. OK, so now we want to do one more thing. We want to get an affine version of these Hecke algebras. Okay, so again, we'll fix some commutative ground ring, and now we'll fix two parameters, although we won't see this second parameter until later. So we take the category we just defined that gave us these Hecke algebras, and now we're going to add in one more generator. So we'll denote it by a dot. So we'll declare it's invertible, which means actually there's some other generator which is the inverse of this, but I won't write that one down. And one additional relation, which is when this dot slides through this crossing, it flips the crossing. Okay, so there's another relation. And I'll translate this into algebra in a second for those of you who have seen this algebra before but written down purely algebraically. Okay. So, but now the endomorphisms in this category of the n-fold tensor product of this generating object are the affine Hecke algebra of type an minus 1. Okay, so some of you may have seen this thing written down purely algebraically. So let me just show you how you translate between the string diagrams and this algebraic description.
Is there anything you know between T and A to Z?
Yeah, in fact, the T won't come till later. I didn't need it here. This will be later when we enlarge this category a bit more. Okay, so let's match this with the usual algebraic definition of the Hecke algebra. So the algebraic way that you write down the definition of this affine Hecke algebra, you've got generators Ti as I goes between 1 and n minus 1. These are like the analogs of the simple transpositions but for the Hecke algebra. And then you've got these polynomial generators, xj, and they're invertible. So you've got plus or minus 1, and the index goes between 1 and n. So when we want to translate this into the string diagrams, we just keep in mind two conventions. We're going to number our strands from right to left. This makes some things easier later on. And remember, we read diagrams from bottom to top. Okay? So Ti corresponds to this generator. So we're numbering our strands from right to left. So this is the crossing of the I and I plus first strands. And we just choose our conventions so that Ti corresponds to this positive crossing where this strand on top goes from bottom left to top right. And this, this polynomial generator, xj, is a dot on the jth strand. Okay? So now let's just look at our relations. So algebraically, one of the relations is that distant transpositions commute. But as we already discussed, that follows for free from the interchange relation. So we didn't need to put a relation into our category for this one. Then there's the Braid relation. And that's exactly this relation that we imposed, right? Because if you read this from bottom to top, this is Ti, Ti plus 1, Ti. So it's the right-hand side of this equation. And this is Ti plus 1, Ti, Ti plus 1. So it's the right-hand side. So it's exactly that relation. Then there's this quadratic relation that you impose when you're defining the Hecke algebras. Now this quadratic relation, you know, if you bring this term over to the left and factor out a Ti, you see it's equivalent to saying that Ti is invertible and Ti inverse is Ti minus Z. Right? That's equivalent to this equation. So the relations that we impose diagrammatically that correspond to this quadratic relation in the Hecke algebra are that we have an inverse, which we write as the other crossing. So these two equations are saying that this other crossing is inverse to this crossing. And then this skein relation, which is the one we imposed here. Okay? So these three relations all together correspond to this quadratic relation when you algebraically define the affine Hecke algebra. Then there's this other relation in the affine Hecke algebra, which is that the Ti and the Xj commute when j isn't I or I plus 1. Again, that one comes for free from this interchange relation, so we don't need to put it into our category. And then there's this relation that Ti Xi is Xi plus 1 Ti inverse. That's another relation in the affine Hecke algebra. And so if you read bottom to top here, this is Xi Ti. And this is Ti inverse, Xi plus 1. So the fact that this dot flips the crossing is just this algebraic relation we've just written diagrammatically. OK, so essentially, we've just defined a category that in an efficient way gives us all of the affine Hecke algebras. OK, so now the actual category that we're interested in, this Heisenberg category, we need a little bit more. OK, so The motivation really comes from it's going to act on categories of modules for these affine Secchi algebras. But to get the actual Heisenberg category, we need a little bit more. So we're going to need to add in another object. And I want to justify the definition and the relations that this other object is going to satisfy. So it comes, part of it comes from the notion of a dual in a monoidal category. So if you have some strict monoidal category and you have two objects, okay, so we'll denote their identities by up and down arrows. Then let's say you wanted a morphism from the unit object to this tensor product. Right? So again, you can sort of draw any picture there you want, but a natural picture would be something like this, because we want at the top it to be a down and an up arrow, and then maybe some dashed line for the identity object. However, if you look at the axioms of a strict monoidal category, tensoring with the identity of the unit object doesn't do anything. This is an identity operation. So in fact, you often don't even draw this dashed line because it just doesn't do anything, tensoring with this dashed line. So in fact, you usually draw a morphism like this as a cup, like this, where you've got nothing on the bottom. That tells you that the domain is the unit object. And at the top, we've got down up. So this is some picture that in the string diagram calculus would denote a morphism from here to here. And similarly, this type of picture would be a morphism from up, down to the identity object. OK, so in a monoidal category, or a strict monoidal category, we say that an object down arrow is right dual to an object up arrow, or conversely, up is left dual to down, if you have two morphisms like this, and they satisfy this relation, which we call the zigzag relations, that some zigzag like this straightens out. Now, this looks like, you know, certainly in terms of pictures, this is a very natural relation. We can just straighten out strands, right? And if you haven't seen this before, you might wonder why is this called a dual and where does this relation come from? So if you look at the notion of what it means for two functors to be adjoint, there are various ways to formulate this. And one way to write down the definition of what it means for one functor to be right adjoint to another functor is you have natural transformations that are a unit called a unit and a co-unit natural transformation. And if you write down exactly the relations that the unit and co-unit have to satisfy in terms of pictures, you get exactly these relations. So one example of this type of duality is adjoint functors. Right? So this is sort of a generalization of the notion of adjoint functors in the abstract setting of strict monoidal categories. So now we can define this quantum Heisenberg category.
Is there a category that's like a collection of results? You have sort of a category you don't have little tags on your arrows.
Well, here these zigzags are going to the right.
Sure, but what you're going for, in your ultimate example, like are you going to have, is up going to be both left and right?
Yes, it will be. But a priori, we put in a right adjoint, and then you can show it's also left adjoint. So our quantum Heisenberg category, so now we can write down the full definition. So I want to remind you of this canonical commutation relation. So I put the K on the other side here, because for the action that I'm going to define later, it's a bit more natural if the K is negative. So I just move the K to the other side. So this is our canonical commutation relation. So this is something that should hold in the growth endiant group, right? Because by categorifying, I mean we want to define a category whose growth endiant group gives us this Heisenberg algebra. So we should see this as some equality in the growth endiant group. So this means we want some objects, say up and down arrow, where up arrow will correspond to P plus, and down arrow will correspond to P minus. And this equality should be an isomorphism in the category, right? So we want, say, two objects up and down, where down tensor up is isomorphic to up tensor down plus negative k copies of the identity. Then in the growth endiant group, we'll get exactly this relation. Right? So this is the isomorphism we want in our category. So then when we pass to the growth endiant ring, remember multiplying classes is taking tensor product. Right? So this isomorphism will give us exactly this equation, which is of course the same as this equation if we just identify the class of up with P plus and the class of down with P minus. Okay? So this is going to motivate the definition of our category. We're going to exactly impose some relations that give us this isomorphism because we want to see this canonical commutation relation. Okay, so we can now define our quantum.
Just getting literally that example.
Pardon?
Just
Pardon me?
So you're not getting a cone or something like that?
No, actually a direct sum, yeah. So to define this quantum Heisenberg category, so now we'll see the T I introduced later, earlier. So we take this affine Hecke algebra category that gave us the affine Hecke algebras. So the first thing is, in that category, we only had one generating object, this up arrow. So now we add in another object, the down arrow, and we declare it to be right dual to up arrow, right? So as we said, what that means is we add in these two generating morphisms, the right and the left, the right cup and cap, and these relations. Okay, so that's just adding in a right dual. And then we add in some more generating morphisms and relations to give us this isomorphism, right? Because that's the isomorphism we want if we want to categorify the Heisenberg algebra. Okay, so how do we get this isomorphism? So let me write this on the board so that on the next slide we still have it. So we want this isomorphic to up tensor down plus k cup minus k copies.
Well, k.
I said k is negative. For reasons that make other things easier later. So this is actually a positive number of copies. So we want an isomorphism like this, right? So what does an isomorphism, you know, from something to a direct sum look like? So a morphism from here to here is really a matrix. You've got a component from each component of this isomorphism from here to here, and then from each copy of here to here. So it's a matrix of morphisms. Okay, so there are three equivalent ways to get this isomorphism. Okay, so first of all, here, so just focus on this matrix right now. This is a 1x2 matrix, right? And it's got just two entries. So this one we've built out of our generators because we have this crossing and we have this right cup and cap. So that's something that's in our category. Its domain is up, down, and its codomain is down, up. So it goes exactly from here to here. Right? By the way, I'm just writing for here the case k equal minus 1 because it's simpler to write, and the general case is very simple. It is very similar.
Can you inverse a non-square matrix?
Yes, you can, because these aren't numbers, so the idea of it being square doesn't really make sense. So it's okay. So I'm writing on the case k equal minus 1. So we've got one copy of this. Right? So this matrix right here, without the inverse, is exactly a morphism from here to here, right? The first component goes from here to here, and the second component goes from here to here, right? So we want to declare this to be invertible. So what that means is its inverse should be a 1x2 matrix, and we just have to give some names to its entries. These will be generators, new generators. So we call them left cap and left crossing, and we declare these two to be inverses to each other. Okay, so that means if you multiply them in both orders, you get the identity matrix. So that's a bunch of relations that you get on these new generators.
This is minus TZ.
Yeah, so these were some parameters we fixed. Yeah. So, I mean, we can just define this any way we want. So we introduce these parameters here so that some calculations later work out on the nose. And it turns out there's one other relation that you want to impose because it makes your category nice, it makes your category pivotal, and I'll come to this later. Okay, so, but I think this is the important one. We impose this inversion relation precisely so that this thing is an isomorphism. It's exactly the isomorphism we want in our category. The second approach is that, well, we could have written another natural morphism from here to here, because we had two crossings. We had this positive crossing and this negative crossing. Here's another matrix that goes from here to here where we just use the other crossing. We could have enforced the condition that that one's invertible, right? And it turns out that they're equivalent. If this one's invertible, you can show that that one's invertible. And if that one's invertible, you can show that this one's invertible. Okay, so even though we made a choice, it doesn't matter which choice you make. You end up with the same category in the end.
So I have a question. So slightly lost. Are these categories braided or not?
They are not braided, no.
So even though you have the undercrossing and overcrossing are different, that's just notation rather than...
Yeah, it's because the dot doesn't slide through these crossings, so it doesn't actually give you a braiding. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's actually a third approach too, which is instead of this sort of abstract idea that this thing is invertible, it's you actually just write down some extra generators and relations, and you can write down all the relations, right? So this is what you get if you do that. So, well, we already saw this ones on the first line and the second line, and these ones on the last line here are essentially just working out what it means for those two matrices to be inverses of each other. If you just write down what it means for those two matrices to be inverses of each other, you get this, you get these relations, okay? Except for one more relation that I've omitted here, because there's no dot generator here, right? So what happened to the dot? It's that in this special case where k is minus one, you can actually write the dot in terms of the other generators, it turns out. So you can actually write this dot in terms of these other generators, so you actually don't need it. But then remember, our dot generator was supposed to be invertible, so you need it one extra relation, which is that this thing is invertible. So these are three different ways to define this quantum Heisenberg category.
So this is only when k is minus
one? I just wrote down the definition for k is minus one, but...
In this case, you wouldn't have this.
Yeah, in the general case, you wouldn't have to put it in this extra one, because you would just, you'd still have to keep the dots. You can only get rid of the dots in the case k equal minus one.
Yeah.
No, you fix a parameter.
It's a linear over some field, or
yeah.
Z and T as formal parameters.
Yeah, well, your K. This is all over K.
K.
I mean, your K, if you wanted to, could be Q, Z, T, and then they're formal parameters if you want.
I mean, there's no reason you couldn't do it in, you know, have FP instead of Q or something.
Right. Yeah. Any ring here. I mean, so they could be formal parameters. Okay, so the main theorem is that all three of these approaches define the same category. And a very nice property, which is related to the question that you asked, it turns out that these categories are strictly pivotal. Okay, so I don't want to go into too much detail about what that means, but what it essentially means, first of all, is that these up and down, these two generating objects are both left and right dual to each other. And you have isotopy invariance for morphisms. So if you draw any picture you want and you just start twisting it around with these cups and caps, it gives you the exact same morphism. Right? This is a very nice thing. And this is what gives some of the applications to topological invariance, not invariance, is that you have this isotopy invariance for morphisms. Okay, so before I say a little bit more, let me relate this to a category that had been defined earlier. So there was another closely related category that had been defined earlier, joint work with Tony Licata. And the connection is essentially the category defined here for this choice where k is minus one and some special choices of our parameters where t is negative z to the inverse and this is z. Then you almost get back this previous category, except that previous category, these dots were not invertible. So you just had positive powers of the dots. Okay, and another special case, an interesting case of this category is where you take k to be zero. So when you take k to be zero, that category is actually much simpler, and it's the affine-oriented Skein category, which had been studied before. And this is an affinization of the Homfly-PT Skein category, which is the category that underpins the Homfly-PT knot invariant. Right? So there are connections to knot theory there when you take k equals zero. Okay, so let me go back to what our goal was to categorify this Heisenberg algebra. Let me say if we've done this. So we wanted some algebra isomorphism from the growth endiac ring of this category to this Heisenberg algebra that I defined before. So under this isomorphism, up arrow should go to P1 plus, and down arrow should go to P1 minus, right? And we saw that canonical commutation relation. We defined the category so that we got the right relation. But there are a couple of problems. First of all, you only take the growth endiac group of an additive category. And in fact, when I wrote down the relation, I used a direct sum, which really actually doesn't make sense yet because this category wasn't additive. But this is a minor thing that's easy to fix. I'll mention in a second. But then there's also this Heisenberg algebra that I said we wanted to categorify was this infinite rank Heisenberg algebra, right? So where are all these other generators coming from, right? So let's explain that. So the answers are, very quickly, and then I'll go into more detail, This one is easy to fix. You just formally add in direct sums to your category. There's just a way to do this. And then to get all these extra generators, we actually have to enlarge our category by taking what's called the idempotent completion of the category. So let me explain what these two things mean. OK, so the formally adding in direct sums, we were implicitly already doing it. So if you take any, say, k-linear monoidal category, and you want to formally make it an additive category, you want to add in direct sums. So you take its additive envelope, which is probably just the naive way that you would enlarge a category to get direct sums. So the objects in this additive envelope are formal finite direct sums of objects in your original category. And then morphisms between any two formal direct sums are just matrices where the entries have the obvious domain and codomain, right? And then you just compose by doing matrix multiplication, right? So it's exactly what I was saying already here, that a morphism from here to here is a matrix, a 2x1 matrix of morphisms. Okay, so that solves the problem of our category not being additive. We just take the additive envelope and now it's additive. That one's easy. The slightly more complex thing is to take the idempotent completion of the category. This gives us a lot of new objects. Okay, so what is this? I'll give the formal definition, and then for people who haven't seen this before, I'll give some intuitive way that you should think about this idempotent completion. So the formal definition is that if you have a category and you want to take the idempotent completion, this is a new category. The objects in this new category are pairs, consisting of an object in your original category and an idempotent endomorphism of that object. And then a morphism between two of these pairs is just an element of the morphism space between the two objects in your original category, but then you hit it on either side with these morphisms, with these idempotents. Okay? So that's the precise definition. Intuitively, the way you should think of it is the following. Let's say you're in some additive category, and you've got an object that decomposes as a direct sum of two other objects. Right? Then there's a natural idempotent sitting around here, which is that you can project onto one sum end and then include back in to your object. That gives you an idempotent. Right? It's just projection onto this sum end. So you may have a category where you've got some object A, and you've got some idempotent endomorphism of that object, but it doesn't correspond to projection onto any sum end, right? And so this is, you say, the category is not idempotent complete. And so idempotent completion is a way of formally adding in these sum ends so that every idempotent is projection onto a sum end. The sum end it's projection onto is the pair A, E. So it's a way of formally adding in these sum ends so that every idempotent is projection onto a sum end. So this is what we do to our category. We're going to take... Yep.
So this, the answer you're going to get is going to depend now on whether you're looking at formal variables or specializing the parameters, because you can easily imagine a situation where it's specialized the parameters that then you can solve some adequate equation.
Right, right.
So will it actually in your example?
Yeah, so I'm going to, there's a result I'll state at the end, which is true in characteristic zero for exactly this reason, that that's a situation where we know what all the idempotents are, and then you can compute things. And it's outside of characteristic zero. It's like when you study the representation theory of the symmetric group, it's much more difficult outside of characteristic zero. So you see that exactly here.
And also,
Right. We want our things to be basically generic. So this is where the Hecke algebra behaves like the symmetric group.
So do you think of this kind of like the weakening of making it an abelian category, just putting in the kernels of the article?
Right, right. Yeah. Okay, so this is what we're going to do to our category, right? But I'll come back to this later. I mean, as you mentioned, we're really enlarging the category because we're adding in all these idempotents. And then to really have a good feel for what your category is, you have to find all the idempotents, right? So this step of going to the idempotent completion can make things a lot more difficult. So remember, we had a natural homomorphism from the Hecke algebra to, well, this should be tensor product, the n-fold tensor product of this object, right? Now, if we're in the generic case, say characteristic zero, where our parameters are generic, then the idempotents in the Hecke algebra are very well known. Okay, so because of this natural homomorphism, any idempotent in the Hecke algebra gives us an idempotent in this endomorphism space. Okay. So in this situation where characteristic zero and the parameters are generic, we know all these idempotents. And so those idempotents give us additional objects that correspond to these additional generators in our Heisenberg algebra. Okay. Now, for the expert, let me say exactly how you get these. So in this characteristic zero generic case, what you have is you have an idempotent for every partition of n. Okay? And then this pair in the idempotent completion corresponds to a sure function. And these generators, the Pn, correspond to the power sums. So that's the precise relation.
So do the power sums correspond to the Sn invariants? I mean, the Hecke algebra is isomorphic to the group algebra, the symmetric group generically.
So ask your question again. Do they correspond?
Do the power sums correspond to passing to the symmetric group invariants? Or is it some other representation?
No, it's you don't see the power sums directly, really, in this picture. You see them when you take this other decategorification, where you take the trace of the category, and then they correspond to n cycles. But in this growth and Dieck picture, you never really see them directly. But I don't know what you mean when you say, do they correspond to the invariants?
I just mean that the Hecke algebra is isomorphic to the group algebra of the symmetric group.
Right.
So if I have the group algebra of the symmetric group back here in a tensor product, well, the idempotents in there are representations of the symmetric group.
I mean, under this usual isomorphism, the invariants are the complete symmetric.
Okay, so
and the PNs are the characteristic function of the n cycles written as a sum of characters.
Okay, so there's no clear.
Yeah, so there's already. I mean, somehow if you're thinking about characters in symmetric group, you can think about class functions, right? And somehow PN most naturally corresponds to the indicator function of being an n cycle. Which is an example of a class function.
Right.
Obligated to expand it as a character. I mean, that's right.
Yeah. So you in theory can write these PNs as in terms of these S lambdas, but the problem is you get coefficients that aren't all positive integers, so it doesn't naturally correspond to some object in your category. What you'd see more naturally is these S lambdas. And there you see these sort of sure positivity results can be naturally interpreted in terms of these categories, because when you take a tensor product of two objects, you get a positive sum of other objects. So it's these sure functions that are natural here. So what can we say? Have we categorified the Heisenberg algebra? Well, almost. What you can show is that there's an injective algebra homomorphism from the Heisenberg algebra to the growth and Dieck group of this idempotent completion, which is sometimes called Kruby envelope. That's why KAR here, of the additive envelope of the Heisenberg category.
And there you are, even for that, you need to assume that Z is generic.
Yeah, here I'm assuming that the characteristic zero and the parameters are generic. Yeah.
Non-generic, you wrote down the generators, but non-generically expect that there's a
map
that's not
an injection. Those idempotents don't exist for special value. Like when Q is a root of unity, those idempotents
so
don't
exist. So I guess we're in the field of fractions.
Yeah, I mean, as long as you assume Z isn't a root of unity, you're fine.
So the conjecture that this is an isomorphism, and why is this a conjecture? I mean, what's the difficulty? The difficulty is that we've passed to this idempotent completion, or this Kruby envelope, and there's this problem. How do you know you found all the idempotents? We have these idempotents that correspond to the ones you get from the Hecke algebra, but those are all idempotents on just upward pointing strands. Maybe there's some complicated diagram involving cups and caps that happens to be an idempotent. And this is very difficult to show that you've gotten all the idempotents, right? Now, in the degenerate case, let me just say, there is a situation where this is a theorem. So essentially, if you take Z to be zero, so we're back in that case of the symmetric group instead of the Hecke algebra. So the first Heisenberg category was defined in that setting by Kovanov. So you can think of it as the k equal minus 1, z equals 0 version of the category defined here. And then Kovanov gave exactly this statement. There's an injective algebra homomorphism. He conjectured it's an isomorphism. That was the status. And then various people extended Kovanov's construction. So you can go to general k. This was done in joint work with McKay and then refined by John Brunden. You can add in a Frobenius algebra, which I'll discuss briefly at the end. And then this categorification conjecture that this is an isomorphism was proved in this degenerate setting, the z equals zero, just recently in joint work with John and Ben. The reason the technique there, we can't immediately apply it to prove this conjecture, is essentially because these polynomials, these dots are invertible. So there's a nice filtration that you can use in the degenerate setting that you can't use in this z not equals zero setting. So it's still a conjecture in the setting I've defined. Okay, so you might say, why are we interested in these categories? I mean, why do you want to categorify the Heisenberg algebra? What do you want to do with these categories? And really, you can think of these categories, studying these categories is really studying certain representation theory. Okay, so let's take where k is not equal to zero. This Heisenberg category acts naturally on modules for cyclotomic Hecke algebras, which are sort of generalizations of Irohori Hecke algebras. And so this K corresponds to the level of these cyclotomic Hecke algebras. So I'll just briefly say how it works without going into any details, really. So these cyclotomic Hecke algebras are nested inside each other. They have a chain of algebras, right? You can think of, for instance, the symmetric groups, how they're nested inside each other, okay? So then what you have is you have induction and restriction functors that go up and down this chain. You have a module for H1 you can induce, you get a module for H2, and you can restrict back the other way. And the category, this Heisenberg category, acts on the sum of the category modules for all these algebras, where the up arrow acts by induction and the down arrow acts by restriction. And so these morphisms, the cups, the caps, the crossings, these are all natural transformations between compositions of induction and restriction functors. And what you're really studying is the relations between these induction restriction functions and natural transformations between them. And the fact that this category is pivotal that I mentioned, which is that you have this isotopy invariance, corresponds at least partially to the fact that induction and restriction are biadjoint. So you have Frobenius reciprocity here. That's diagrammatically, the fact that you're in a pivotal category. Yeah, so you have one of these cyclotomic Hecke algebras. You're modding out by some polynomial in the generator f(x1). That's that polynomial, and its degree is this k. Right.
Is this
a
cyclotomic polynomial?
Yeah.
Right. Well, people were first interested in the case where it was a cyclotomic polynomial, but there's nothing special in this picture.
Yeah, it can be any polynomial of degree opposite value of k, and you're modding out by the ideal f of x1 is 0.
There was some original number theory reason where it was particularly interesting to do this for cyclotomic polynomials, and then people kind of said, oh, wait, you could put any polynomial here.
People still call it cyclotomic algebra.
Right, this is where the name comes from.
Is there some, like, the geometric interpretation of these algebras, like quantizations of functions on some space?
Well, it's more like there are geometric relations, but from flag varieties and Steinberg varieties.
Right, I mean, you can think of them as, I mean, the affine Hecke algebra is the K theory of the Steinberg. And is there actually some natural way to see this guy as some K theory?
I was thinking like the Daz, she's in the Edwards game.
Oh, well, that's an interesting question, but it's not obvious what the connection is at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. Right, so another way of saying that induction and restriction are biadjoint, there's a word for this, is that when each of these is a Frobenius extension of the previous one, that exactly means that induction and restriction are biadjoint. Also, these categories, so that what I just described was the case where k is not zero. When k is zero, they also act on something very natural, but it's something a bit different. So if you take this k to be zero, and you take your parameter t to be q to the n, then this category acts, and your z is q minus q inverse, acts on representations of the quantized enveloping algebra of GLN. So here, the up arrow acts by tensoring with the natural module, and the down arrow acts by tensoring with the dual of the natural module. And this is an extension of a functor that had been constructed by Turayev. So he constructed a monoidal functor from the Homfly PT Skine category to the category of finite dimensional modules over these things. And this is an affine version of that. That dot acts like the full braiding on these modules. So it's an extension of this where you add in this extra generator, this dot. And you can get nice things out of this. So for instance, once you have this action, it follows at the center of the category. And what the center of a category is its endomorphisms of the unit object. So in terms of pictures, that's pictures that are closed diagrams, right? So in this category, the center is closed diagrams. And these map surjectively, you can show, onto the center of UQGLN. So you get a diagrammatic calculus for this center. You can do computations with these pictures, and you're doing computations in the center of this category, or of this algebra. Now, it's nice to know a basis for morphism spaces for this category, for applications. And the usual approach that in these sort of, when people define these monoidal categories in this flavor, the usual way you define you get a basis theorem is using the categorical actions. So first of all, it's usually not hard to guess what your basis sort of should be. To show that that's a spanning set is usually not that hard. There's some procedure for simplifying diagrams to some standard form. And then you want to show that your candidate basis is linearly independent, and that's usually the difficult part. And the way that people usually do it is you use these categorical actions, right? So you have these actions, you know something about this representation theory, explicit bases, and you can show there's some asymptotic faithfulness as n goes to infinity. So given any linear combination, you can show that if you take n high enough, it acts as something non-zero. You can show that you have linear independence in that way. But when we tried that for this category, we ran into a problem, is that the center of this category is bigger than you would expect. So you don't have this asymptotic faithfulness. And so you need another technique. And so the other technique, I'm not going to go into detail here, but it involves defining a categorical version of the coproduct on these categories. And this is based on an unfurling technique that Ben used in some previous papers. And then you can get a large enough representation of this category that allows you to show that these things are linearly independent.
The K-theory doesn't have any coproduct.
Pardon me?
So the K-theory doesn't seem to have a coproduct. How can we expect the K-theory?
Well, I mean, this coproduct, it's a very strange thing. And in particular, it's sort of somehow we are avoiding some non-generic locus. So, I mean, it's called like coproduct because it sort of categorifies the coproduct of Heisenberg.
On which the level's at?
On which the level's at, yeah.
I see, so this is something like that too, K adds on it?
Yeah, it's sort of you, right, that we kind of know about these representations of level one, and then you can kind of combine a bunch of them together.
Right, so it's a way to, yeah, define a much larger representation, which is nice. So you can define, so these things that you want to show are linearly independent act sort of generically. Okay, so now at the very end, I want to just mention some future directions. So what are some ways that you can generalize things? One way that you can generalize these Heisenberg categories is that you can incorporate what's called a Frobenius algebra. So Frobenius algebra, if you haven't seen them before, it's an algebra where you've got some non-degenerate trace or some non-degenerate invariant bilinear pairing. And then you can define a quantum Frobenius Heisenberg category. And in fact, this Frobenius can be a superalgebra if you want. And the only difference is that now you've got some extra generating morphisms, which are you denote by some sort of blue dots, maybe some tokens that are labeled by elements of this Frobenius algebra. And you have some additional relations. You modify things a bit. So this Skein relation, you now, before it was just the identity here, now you get a sum over a basis of that basis element and its dual. So the fact that Frobenius algebra, you've got a pairing, you've got dual elements. And so you just modify the relations. These new generators slide through these crossings, and they slide through the dots. And you can modify the whole definition, and it goes through. And almost everything goes through. These act on categories of modules over Frobenius versions of degenerate affine Hecke algebras, et cetera, or affine Hecke algebras, et cetera. But there's a lot of work still to be done here. So for instance, in the case k equals 0, you get some Frobenius deformation of this affine-oriented Skein category. And then you can ask, what does it naturally act on? So this is open. It should act on modules for some sort of Frobenius algebra deformation of this quantized enveloping algebra, whatever that is. Right? And when k is not equal to zero, now here we know what they act on. One can define quantum affine Riethe algebras, which generalize affine Hecke algebras, affine Sergeyev Hecke algebras. That's when your Frobenius algebra is the Clifford algebra. And they act on cyclotomic quotients of these things. And some other further directions. People have been studying traces of these sorts of categories. Heisenberg categories also categorified quantum groups. So a trace is another way of decategorifying. Instead of taking the growth and deit group, you take the trace of the category, which in terms of pictures corresponds to drawing your diagrams on an annulus. Right? And then you lose the structure of a category and you just get an algebra, just like for the growth and deit group. So people have been studying traces of these things. So this deformed Heisenberg category that I briefly mentioned, people have computed the trace of this. It's related to an elliptic Hall algebra. So one would expect that this slightly larger category defined here is also related to this elliptic Hall algebra. And there should be connections to Katz-Moody 2 categories. So in particular, because algebraically, there are relations between Heisenberg algebras and affine Lie algebras. So you should be able to do all this on the level of categories. So in particular, if you have an action of a Heisenberg category, you should be able to define an action of a Katz-Moody 2 category. And vice versa, if you have an action of a Katz-Moody 2 category, you should be able to get an action of a Heisenberg category. It's a bit like the boson-fermion correspondence. And so this is work in progress that extends some sort of baby case that's been done in level one. Okay, I'll stop there.
I guess a bit surprising for me is that you just started with a category involving one their operator and p plus and p minus, and you get the other one by representations of the Hecke algebra very naturally.
Right.
Is there a kind of classical fact corresponding to this?
No, I thought about this a bit too. I mean, they come because you take this idempotent completion, but right. How you should expect this algebraically is a bit.
So there's nothing like this.
No, it's quite different there. Yeah, it's more like if you're studying representation theory of the symmetric group, if you take tensor powers of the natural representation, inside there you see all the representations of the symmetric group. That's sort of the fact that you're seeing here. But there has some ends. That's the idempotent completion. So you take the natural representation, take some tensor products, and then as some ends, you see all the other representations. Yeah, it's like class functions.
I mean, you know, I don't know. Somehow I think this is, in this categorification world, this is just something we've come to accept, that like somehow magically these things that look very strange on the decategorified level just sort of like somehow magically pop out. You know, there's this sort of related story about categorical actions of Katz-Moody algebras, and these are somehow just magically always integrable for reasons which like are a little bit strange. I mean, somehow like it's harder to do the wrong thing.
So, wait, if I could just ask this a little bit more about that. So essential to this was the fact that the Hecke algebra could take a unit object, which is one variable, like that. So that's what you were using.
Acted on the unit object. Well, we built the category by sort of building in the Hecke algebra.
Yeah, the Hecke algebra. Yeah. Part of your construction of the one.
Right.
Category.
Yeah.
And that's why you can take
your right. Right.
So is there a classical corresponding to this Hecke algebra built in
the beginning? Is there a what? Sorry?
A classical
Well, no, because it doesn't have to be the Hecke. It could have been the symmetric group. That's what was Kamanov's original one. I think, okay, so this is a way I would think about it. The Heisenberg algebra, one way of defining it is it's what's called the Heisenberg double of the Hopf algebra of symmetric functions. And the Hopf algebra of symmetric functions can be built from representations of the symmetric group. product and co-product come from certain induction restriction. And this was known, this goes back, I think, to the 70s or 80s, back to Geisinger. And it's the fact that the Hecke algebra, it's generically, it's representation theory. I mean, it's just isomorphic to the group algebra, the symmetric group. So you see the same symmetric functions.
Yeah, there is somehow, if you just kind of said, like, oh, what's kind of the natural category that I get by looking at induction and restriction on Hecke algebras and that the kind of obvious natural transformations, you could kind of discover all these relations by just doing computations there.
And in fact, that's how I said there was this connection to this first one. And this is how we did this. We just looked at, you know, Kovanov had done it for the symmetric group, and we said, well, let's do a similar thing for the Hecke algebra. And you just actually, you're just doing computations and representations, induction, restriction, and seeing how these things, you're just computing everything, and it spits out this category. Right. You construct it so that it acts. And that's where the relations come from.
Did you actually tell us a category of k other than 1 or something like that? Maybe I don't
know
whether k was 1 or minus 1, but I don't think you told it.
So no, but I can tell you very efficiently what it is, but then it hides a lot of stuff. So,
because when you first read that, like.
Right. So we want this isomorphism, right? And so I said the way you define this to be invertible. In general, K, you just, this matrix is bigger, and you've got this cup, and then a cup with a dot, and then a cup with two dots, up to K minus one dots, and you require that to be invertible.
So, I was going to ask, like, there's, before categorifying, there were two sort of various relations between different levels. I guess one of them you sort of said was already there in this unfurling, where kind of I can take the level K theory and kind of stick it inside of K copies of the level one theory.
Right.
I assume that works here.
Yeah, I mean, somehow you should think of that as kind of if you have, you know, the first, you know, the zero, the first, whatever, the k minus first power of a variable, you can evaluate it at k different places, and that's sort of, you know, isomorphic to the.
So the other thing that you can also do is in the very first presented the algebra, like I could have just sort of changed, if I wanted to, I could stick, another way I could stick the level k theory in just one copy of the level one algebra by like taking pn for level k and sending it to pkn. Is that something you can do in this categorical world?
Well, the pn's aren't so natural here. Except for p1. So you'd have to unravel what that is doing.
I mean, that's just like rescaling the free boson. That's not a very deep thing to do the decategorical.
Right, but rescaling on level categories is a more complicated thing because these should be the class of some object.
I mean, it's just. No, so even at the deep, even on the vertex algebra, it's anything to do.
I mean, you'd need something like relating representations of SK and SMK. Which, I mean, there certainly are such things, but, you know, like, that's somehow a bit tricky.
Do you have any comments on the logic of giving computation of some of things you said?
Yeah, unfortunately, people here have had to suffer through a lot of Heisenberg categorification this semester.
No.
You can do it until you figure out how to interpret that in terms of quantum field theory.
It's the topological field theory. I mean, clearly the pictures are TFT pictures.
Yeah, no, it's true. Like,
no, I don't think I can.
It's no. So embarrassing that we can't.
Especially when you're looking for Frobenius algebra.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Now, the Frobenius algebras you see in TQFTs are usually commutative Frobenius algebras, right?
It depends. Like in open strings, you get non-commutative ones.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they appear in sort of a different way because you don't see them as the diagrams. They're just dots on these diagrams. So, whereas in TQFT, the Frobenius algebra really is the diagram, right? I mean, the pair of pants is the multiplication and co-multiplication.
So maybe there's something Frobeniusy happening in woods.
I'm not thinking the Frobenius algebra also sort of arises very much.
Right.
It did.
Again, on the open strings. I mean,
okay.
So that those dots really were not dots. They were a place where Frobenius string and on your cordero. You put in a blue string that was one end of which is your basis vector, and Frobenius algebra, the other end is the blue dot.
Okay.
And that's what that, you know, you should, I'm saying, you should not draw the label of the algebra at the, on the next bit, you should pull it off a little bit of this stuff.
Okay.
And then you're sort of,
when you have this sum,
then your sum
nine.
Is just two things stuck together by an open blue string. So it really is exactly the open string for the algebra.
Okay.
You have a question. So, when you want to study categorifying the Jones polynomial,
right.
you get some categorical gadget with the GM action, and you recover the Jones polynomial not by taking the trace, but by a twisted trace with respect to that GM action.
Okay.
So here you didn't do that, and yet it's somehow related. So is there any such GM action that you use?
Well, the only place I see something like that is sometimes if this Frobenius algebra isn't symmetric, then when you pass things over left cups and caps, you apply this Nakayama automorphism, which could be your GM. But that's the only place I can think of where you see some sort of action like this.
Oh, right. So, yeah.
So when you take the trace, sometimes in the generic situation when your Frobenius algebra is not a symmetric Frobenius algebra, every time you pass one of these tokens around, it picks up this Nakayama automorphism. So you see this sort of thing.
And you mentioned a relationship with
there should be some. Right, because there's this Jones-Akmiano trace on Heck algebra. This is embarrassing, but I haven't thought about this.
But this is closing off the diagram, right?
Is that like on the? Well, wait. I mean. If you take just a braid and you close it, you get an element of the center.
Right.
So you must be somehow evaluating that element of the center somewhere, and there must be something special about the point that gives you the Jones-Akmiano trace.
Well, the way you get these, for instance, the Homfly PT polynomial is that you in your basis theorem, you know that any closed diagram is going to be some multiple of just the bubble. And then that multiple is your Homfly PT polynomial. So as you know, you can always simplify it by resolving crossings and getting some multiple. And that's how you see it.
What parameter is Q? The kind of quantum parameter?
You're probably making some special choices for the Q and the T. I forget what they are to get this polynomial in the nodes. But the basic idea is that any closed diagram is some multiple of this. So you need the basis theorem to get this these invariants.
So this F polynomial that you're using for these Hecker algebras, the number field generated by its roots, is somehow the modules on which this thing acts, are they defined over that field or something?
The little F? This thing that's sometimes a cyclic atomic polynomial. So ask your question again.
So that little f, its roots defines some number.
Okay.
It has rational coefficients.
Okay.
Is there any kind of statement that's true, like this category acts on modules that are defined over that field? Like, where does that number field come up in such a set?
Good question. Somehow I think people. Most of the work I know is sort of thinking about an algebraically closed field. You get the most interesting stuff when that polynomial is kind of weird from the perspective of people who like irreducible polynomials. So in particular, one of the most interesting cases is when you have multiple roots for that polynomial, which obviously isn't so interesting if you want it to generate a number field. But I think also somehow the algebra is, you know, it depends sensitively on what the polynomial is, not just like what the field it generates is. So it certainly is true that you could do everything over that field, but I'm not sure what interesting stuff.
So if I pick different generators, should it be able to move that up?
I think you would end up, you could end up with a completely different algebra.
But I guess what I'm asking is about the module, not some CL. So, what's the module? I'm just, well, maybe I have to read some more things. I'm just wondering how that polynomial.
I mean, sometimes, right, like when you decategorify, you just take some dimension. You don't even see what the base field is. So one of the funny things is, right, these sort of categorifications, they like take in the base field as some sort of extra parameter that gives you lots of different flavors of categorifications. And I mean, somehow, like, for example, the behavior of the category is very different depending on whether there are roots of that polynomial where the difference is an integer. Right, and that's something that's like, I mean, I don't think that's like an intrinsic property of the number field, right? Is there some interesting thing about number fields where like there's a corresponding polynomial where the difference between some of the roots are integers?
It's called an all number.
Oh, that happened in all number fields?
Well, if, I mean, if you're allowed to repeat it, a root or a root shifted by a rational number.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think he was thinking about like the minimal polynomial of a primitive generator.
The primitive generator coefficient. Yeah.
Right. I mean, somehow, like being Galois conjugate to you, like u plus an integer, it happens sometimes. It is possible, but like it's not very common. Oh wait, no, maybe it's not possible. No. Okay. So it never happens. So it's always kind of boring. I mean, somehow it's just going to be kind of like you took like the symmetric group and then like somehow like took n copies of the symmetric group and somehow glued those together with the action of the Galois group or something.